Vanity Fair, Kloppman, Milliken, Goodyear, Dixie, Davenport, West Point, Shaw, H.D. Lee, Malden Mills, and so on. But just a handful of them, in various fields, these were, you could tell there were tire companies, hosiery and carpet companies, and so on. So that's that point. But in other words, we did nurture building these close relationships and were successful. The next point is that marketing management's appreciation early on for the necessity for merchandising through the distribution chain to the retail consumer. And a large marketing service and merchandising division was created. I mentioned them before because, as I was talking about, I got the job which had the menswear, womenswear, home furnishings, converter relations, retail, advertising, promotion, that kind of thing. And the interesting thing was that the normal salesmanship became a complex, sophisticated marketing, broad marketing job. I mean, it wasn't just pure selling anymore. You couldn't sell; you had to do the whole smear. That's that point. The next one is that Fibers extended the success of our products in apparel to many diverse end uses, such as tires, belting, hose, carpets and rugs, bedding and pillows, automobile upholstery, so on and so forth. We resold just about everything. Now this next point I've alluded to, and is it was the necessity for a textile research organization to, among other functions, advise which fibers were best for specific end uses, and that became necessary. We went to this five fiber selling, but this became quickly recognized, and we had to learn firsthand by our own experiments and simulation the processing problems our customers were to experience to complete successful selling to the final consumer. And we had to avoid downstream problems that could be disruptive and time consuming to be successful. And we had to know that the final products were useful and saleable.
How did the how did that connect with DuPont Central Research, with the experimental station?
Well, let me try to the Central Research group was separate from all the departments in the company, and they were working on trying to come up with new products altogether. Not anything to do necessarily with fibers, but anything. And make the inventions that would keep the pot rising and successful. And this textile research was just a part of the textile fibers department, and it was managed initially totally in the research division, but it gradually leaked over to a degree in the marketing.
I was wondering, because since the nylon and so on very much came out of Central Research, what was the moment that they really came out?
Well, nylon came right straight from that. And at that point in time, all we had was a little cellulosic fiber kind of business with rayon and astic. But once nylon got on the map, just 1939 through the war and so on, and the research we had it in the out at the experimental station. They did create I'm trying to think the right name for it that they had for the fibers organization out at the experimental station, who carried on the Wallace Carruthers leads to other possible new products like polyester and Orlon and so on. And so they, out at the station, would then feed these ideas at a certain point in time, fairly early, into the department organization, into its research group.
Which was much more production-oriented.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
I mean, weren't there issues there around morale? I mean, I'd rather invent a new nylon than simply improve the one you've got.
Yes. Well, you know, at some point you start to run out of brand new new ventures. I mean, the last ones we came up with, which were so successful, was Kevlar. But it, I think that over the years, as you move through the 70s and into the 80s, I mean, if you could come up with an invention of a modification of one of our products that was good, it meant everything to keep the venture going and keep trade excited. And we probably had hundreds for each one of our fibers, variations that were, and I'm not going into them, and there it's unbelievable, but we constantly were coming up with very, and this is still going on right today.
Which is typically done by PhD chemists, or by what?
No, it's done by basically PhD chemists.
Yeah.
In our research,
in textile
in
fibers,
fibers research, divisions.
But didn't you have wasn't it a problem to recruit people to work there? I mean, if I'm graduating from university or something.
No, I don't think so, because you had a phenomenal history. I mean, my God, dude. If you look back, if you were going out to Purdue or something, where Bob Forney and many of our other leaders went, you had a fantastic story to sell them the BMs. In fact, I suspect they were chasing the punt, because there was nothing, no company, no anything that had the success in this field.
But wouldn't central research have the edge in...
Oh, in hiring versus...
Yes.
Well, that's a very good question. You can look at it two ways. I guess it depends an awful lot on the individual. But if you wanted to really get into something where you were inventing from scratch or something, I think you'd want to get more into central research. But if you wanted to get aboard something that's very specific, that had been very successful, where there was a need for still more products, I think you'd want to go with the sound, I can't think of the right name yet, out of this station of our textile group out there.
Mm-hmm. I can remember talking with Howie Simpson.
I guess they call it Textile Research Laboratory, that's what it's called.
I remember talking with Howie Simmons, it must have been at least a dozen years
ago,
and he was very disenchanted about what the DuPont company had done with research. And
well, I think there are a lot of people that felt that way, and probably many of them would agree 1,000% with Howie on that. I think one of the criticisms of the DuPont company today is they let that slide to a degree. Now, the current management of the fund company that will argue that there's still research means everything and all this kind of thing, but the percentage of dollars and so on is, and the success rate has just not been quite. You see, the company sort of shifted, I don't know how many years ago, it was probably in the middle 80s, to thinking there were certain industries like the pharmaceutical industry, drug industry, and we spent fortunes getting into that business, and then we ended up selling it. But the dollars and effort and the top manpower we put in are fantastic. And then more recently, this has been true of biotechnology and the seed companies and this kind of thing. But in one sense, it's been good because they've recognized, and I'll get into this in a little bit, that the days of fibers were short-lived. And I'll be touching on this in a little while. You could write a whole new book on the research situation. Maybe you were doing that when you were talking to Howie, but that's be fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you're going to say the. I think we could say objectively and factually that there was a flow of these new products and product modifications that in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s drove the development of a very, very successful business.
Right.
But here in 2002, something's changed.
Oh, that's your head.
Now, is that simply an inevitable change, or did something change in the management philosophy and strategy? I mean, was it in the end a mistake and a failure, or simply an inevitability?
I think it was an inevitability. Let me just say this, and I'll be touching on this later, that the CEOs, the last four of them, or three of them at least, have been fibers oriented. In fact, they're ex-fibers guys, trained in fibers.
This is made, but just name
this
them.
Start. Ed Willard was the first, Jack Kroll, and now Chad Holliday. All are fibers guys, grew up in the system I'm talking about. Every one of them. And so, you got to remember that as you ask this question. God knows they have strong feelings about the fibers, but they could see, and I'll be touching on this in a minute, that we were fighting a long-term losing battle.
Were you aware of that in your active days?
That's I'm going to touch on that.
Okay.
Because it's amazing. And this is 2002. I retired in 84, but in 1980, we knew then that our competition for the future was China. It wasn't Celanese, it wasn't Monsanto, it wasn't Hertz in Europe or ICI, anybody like that. It's the Chinese, and you're in this kind of business because they got into the technical side a bit. They had fibers plants even poked upon, and our competition sold them plants. Their labor cost is zero almost, I mean relatively. And it was apparent 4 years before I retired, and our management was saying, look, we have to find a way to compete with the Chinese or we won't be around here. There was no question about it. It was inevitable. I mean, and so when the company recently decided to sell the business, it didn't surprise me a damn bit. The hell we've been saying this would happen. And it's not that we're not still making money there and pretty handsomely, but it's a very declining, relatively steep curve. And DuPont can't afford that. We have an expensive organization to run and the philosophy is such.
Well, the answer in 2002 is sell, but what was the answer in 1980?
Well, in 1980, we thought we had a fighting chance then I'm jumping ahead here a bit, but it wasn't just that reducing costs down to levels we couldn't even dream of, but we had to have technical routes to making things in a much different way than we ever had before, to come up with inventions, you really might say, of like a spun bonnet, make a fabric right off the bat out of the spinneret and use it for apparel. Well, none of our spun bonnets could do that, but if you could do that, that would be a way of jumping ahead of the Chinese. But, and since we'd had success in some of those things, I think in 1980 we thought, both through the cost route and through new inventions, might be able to pull it off. But I think we, as the 80s and got to the 90s, you began to see that you only had a limit on what you could do.
Was that limit set by nature, or was it that the investments were going elsewhere in the company?
No, I think it became apparent that technically we couldn't pull this off. There weren't that many, and we couldn't visualize inventions that would go beyond the ones we kept coming up with. Damn good ones. You can't imagine how many hundreds. But it just evolved. Well, let me just move on here a little bit. This is an important point in a way. Fibers consistently contributed outstanding corporate profits. And for many years, we were one-third of the company's sales and 50% of the earnings.
What can you roughly date the era that was true for?
Well, I would say 60s, 70s, early 80s. Now, this is off the top of my head, and I'm not a financial guy.
You mentioned that these three CEOs recently came out of Fibers, but if you're in the 60s, where were the CEOs from?
For a long time they were DuPonts. But that ended, I guess, with Lamont DuPont Copeland. Memory is hazy here, but I think the next CEO was Brown McCoy, mm-hmm. who came out of Explosives, basically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was followed by Irving Shapiro, who came out of Legal. And
then Ed Jefferson.
And Jefferson had been in plastics, basically. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson was followed by Dick Hecker. He didn't come out of Fibers. I'm trying to remember what. I think he may have come out of plastics also. I'm not sure.
So it's only recently the delay.
Yeah, well, then it started when Ed Woolard moved in. But meanwhile, some of these guys, they didn't reach the top, but they became right under the top. And Bob Forney's a very good example. It was Les Sinis who did extremely well. I name them a little later on here, but we were successful in developing people who were right up under the top. The next point is that we consistently, that's fiber, demonstrated the ability to stay ahead of competition and retain high market share. And this required top fiber quality, reliable delivery, technical service, new fiber variations to keep the trade excited, processing improvements, dependability, and company integrity. I mean, the trade knew they could trust and depend on the product.
Who was the serious competition? Who was the not so serious competition?
Well, competitions almost all types of serious one way or another, but the biggies were, well, in this country, of course, we were competing against the European two, like ICI, Hearst, and Bayer, and so on. But in this country, there were Celanese, there was Chemstrand, there was Allied Chemical. God knows I ought to be able to remember quickly the others, but those were the key ones.
DuPont seems to have all the well-known trade names, as it were.
I should have that as a separate point. That's a good point. Well, you say trade names, they're trademark names.
Yeah.
And well, we recognized early on, it goes back to Nylon, that was a generic, and we thought to ourselves, wow, did we miss the boat? So when polyester came along, it was a terrific chore to come up with a name that would, you know, pass and not be conflicting. And we would often have three or four, trial names, but names we would launch them as, and then have to change. And this is the very early stages. But that had to happen because these trademarks weren't easy to come up with. But the big ones, of course, were all on with the first one. But that was called something else. I can't remember quickly what it was. And then we had Daquan. That was called something else. Amilar or something. I can't remember. And then we had Lycra. And so on. But the reason those trademarks were so important was to distinguish ourselves from competition. Mm. Now, as time has gone on, price has become so important, and the merchandising, and you don't have the same chance to do what you did back in the 70s and 80s. The trademarks are not quite as important, but they still can be in certain instances. Another point here is that we had manufacturing success in producing consistent, high-quality products while simultaneously lowering costs and investment per pound. An unbelievably great manufacturing organization. At the same time, fibers had no labor relations or work stoppages. Manufacturing consistently overcame seemingly insurmountable processing problems in all our products, including the spunbonded. Some days, in my experience, I felt we couldn't continue a process, and in the middle of the night, someone seemed to come up and invent a way around the problem, over and over, hundreds of times. But manufacturing was just dedicated to doing the job well, and but their brilliance in being able to overcome some of the problems. You can't imagine some of the problems they had. And they just didn't seem any way around them, and then they would come up with something. And you got so you almost assumed it would happen.
How did they... these days we hear a lot about stock options and motivators. Yeah. I mean, what kept everybody motivated?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I'll be touching on one point here that may explain it to a degree, but when I would hear out in the trade, I was out among, when I got into going around the world and everything else, we, in the DuPont company, and in particular the fibers department, I felt, we had an esprit de corps and a kind of people that in today's world were almost too good to be true. I mean, they were high-type people and pulling together, and it just a very unusual working environment at DuPont. I mean, in a way, you can say it started with integrity. I mean, you always were doing the right things, and that became very, very important. And when you're working with people that all are working hard, you didn't find many slackers very long around the pond, particularly as we got into more cost reducing, and then later years having to take damn good people and give them a golden handshake just to get the cost reduction. But we grew damn good people. And if you weren't a good person, you didn't stay around that very long.
Was that in part coming from the family in the end?
I think if you go back, I'd say, yeah, it started really with the family, in a sense. They certainly believed all this, and they had very high-type people. Go back to the 20s, and Pierre DuPont, Walter Carpenter, and some of them were just great. Irénée DuPont. They sort of set the stage. There's no damn question about it.
Did you sense any change in that over the course of your career? I mean, was it the same in 84 as in 44?
Yes. 45.
Yeah,
it was. I didn't mind. Now, I'm sure you would have people today say it's different, and it's not quite the same. And a lot of that is because of conditions in the world markets and the radical changes that we've had to make to try to keep our profits up and growing and so on. But it's not my way of thinking much more than that. I mean, you have to do certain drastic things that they didn't have to quite do to the same degree up until the time I retired. And I'd hate to be in Chad Holliday's, anybody's shoes today with the problems they've got. Mm-hmm. The difference they were.
Mm-hmm.
Whole world has changed. I talked to you a minute ago, first a lot about marketing and talked about research and all that. Well, I talked to the research to the degree of the manufacturing, how great they were, but I wanted to say one more thing about research, that they had the talent, seemed to me, decade after decade, to regularly create a backlog of new fibers and variations. And because of our early successes, the trade, from direct customers down through retail, were convinced to work with DuPont fibers, but it starts back at research, and they're coming up with these things, and then manufacturing excellence and developing them, and so on, and then we can market it.
So there's a lot of kind of discussion out there about whether research gets too remote from the practical problems or gets too absorbed by the immediate problems. The balance seems to have been very good for a long time. Was that difficult to maintain? How did that work?
Well, I can't talk firsthand except up through 84, but in my opinion, up through that point, the balance was, I'd say, pretty good. It's never perfect, but I'd say it was quite good.
I mean, how was it actually managed to sort of have the sales and research people talking, or how did it work?
It worked mainly because of you had to have a leader who believed in all these people talking a lot. Now it's the time today where you've done away with department organization, you have business units, and one person is doing five things they used to do. It's you could say it's easier now because you got so damn few management people. But in the days up until the time I'm retired, it was really the philosophy of the leaders who made sure that he would have staff meetings. He had the research people there, the manufacturing people, the marketing people there, and he would bang their heads together.
So there were regular meetings together.
Oh, sure.
Part of the structure.
Yeah. Oh, yes, very much so. It's a way of managing, and we really had top managers. The amazing thing is sort of what happened since I retired, when Ed Willard was in. I mean, how we could have created a guy that had the leadership to do what he did. I mean, one thing that was it was just the heart and soul of the DuPont company, and everybody worked with it. We had an executive committee, we had a finance committee, and we had these departmental structures. They were written up in Harvard Business School. Boy, the perfect organization. He did away with them. He did away with the finance committee, executive committee, and then the department structure, which was in like the guts Andy Buchanan has shown in the 50s and 60s on developing these things. He did this organizationally in the company. That's after my period, but I observed, I said, wow, what courage to do that. I mean, he stand up against the whole family and everything else, because this was, Bob was marvelous, and a lot of it because of this structure. It went out the window, which was necessary, but